Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:45 p.m. and today is Friday. It's the Big Picture Long-Term Audio and Video for the various different asset classes, and this is June 11th. And I thought we'd kick off and look at the central bank balance sheets in aggregate in US dollars. And it's up to about 31.35 trillion. So it's a lot. And it's up a lot since 2006 as well. We can definitely think about, though, the trend. There are a couple of things that I think are really worth pointing out. I think the first is, of course, that total assets on central bank balance sheets jumped by 50% in the space of the last 18 months. So that's still a lot of money, and that money has to go somewhere. And it's the somewhere is the question about inflation. If we just simply think about inflation as in a Friedman way and think about it in terms of monetary policy, or that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, well, that 50% jump in the balance sheets of central banks is an awful lot of money. So obviously some of it went to compensate everyone for the hiatus in economic activity in 2020. But then there's a lot of money that's also left over. And then there is, of course, the savings rate. So we're also at a point where people are starting to think about excess savings. And one of the places where you have the greatest amount of excess savings is in private equity. Private equity have about $1.4 trillion in dry powder. And there's one way of thinking about it is that they're holding onto that dry powder for a juicy opportunity to come along so that they can deploy it. The other, of course, way of thinking about it is that they have nowhere to deploy it. So that's money that is sitting on the sidelines waiting for an opportunity to both achieve a good price and at the same time find a willing seller. So there was evidence of that back in 2008. There were forced sellers, and private equity were able to move in and buy up massive portfolios of residential real estate, and they became some of the largest landlords to ordinary people in the world. During 2020, we had a moratorium on evictions, so they weren't able to accumulate the same number of distressed homes. Of course, that moratorium on evictions is going to end within the next 4 or 5 months, on the assumption, of course, that it is not delayed, and there is the significant potential that any decision on that front will be delayed. Of course, at that stage, we're going to have, and I guess we already have, some very big questions about property rights and who exactly owns a property if the tenant is squatting and refuses to pay rent but won't move out either. And you can't evict them, but you can't collect rent either. So then obviously there's a property rights issue in the midst of all of this talk about the prospect of evictions. As we think about where we are in terms of the size of central bank balance sheets, then it's worth considering that they were at 5 trillion in 2006 and they're at 31.3 trillion today, and the trend is still going up. And the Federal Reserve is still buying $120 billion worth of bonds every month. One thing that I find particularly interesting, however, is that that quantity of bonds is not being reflected on the central bank balance sheet, because the Fed funds rate is rising, and it's up from about 7 trillion to 8 trillion over the course of the last year. But that's not exactly $120 billion. So we're definitely not seeing that increment being very apparent. And there is a bit of ebb and flow. So we're also seeing that there are maturing bonds. So we're not really seeing $120 billion flowing into this balance sheet from the Fed, but there's no question that the trend is upwards. I think as well, there is an additional lesson that I haven't really seen anyone else talking about, but it is relevant. The Federal Reserve tried to shrink its balance sheet, and they got down to less than 4 trillion, and they had been at about 4.5. So it was a pretty modest attempt to reduce the size of the balance sheet, and the response subsequently required that they double the size of the balance sheet. But this is not the first time this kind of event has happened, because the ECB also tried to reduce the size of their balance sheet in the last cycle. They, in 2012 through to the beginning of 2015, they took more than a trillion out of circulation, and they just about halved the size of their balance sheet, not quite, and then subsequently had to double it. In fact, they had to put in twice as much as they took out. It would probably be the better way of saying that. And then they had a modest period of quantitative tightening between 2018 and early 2020, and then subsequently we had to have this enormous additional infusion. And what's quite relevant here is that the Federal Reserve might be adding in somewhat less on a net basis than $120 billion, but the ECB, and they did announce in here this week that they have not stopped their quantitative easing program and that they are going to persist. So there are two big takeaways. The first is that we're still in an environment where central banks are printing money and extending liquidity and supporting markets. And they have said in plain English that they are going to continue to do that until unemployment is well in hand and that the shock from the pandemic is in the rearview mirror, and that they are willing to tolerate somewhat higher inflation in the near term because they don't believe it's going to last. And the Federal Reserve has been very clear in saying that, and the ECB in here this week said basically the same thing. So the first thing is that these central bank balance sheets continue to expand. And the second is that whenever central banks have attempted to reduce the size of their balance sheets, it has backfired. And they have subsequently had to engage in much more aggressive actions than they had ever really thought possible. So this is important because it is clearly highlighting that we're going to be in an environment of extremely liquid and large central bank balance sheets for the foreseeable future, because no one has really come up with a way of taking that money out of circulation without causing a very significant problem. So it's rational to think about inflation. But then we have to think about, well, what kind of inflation? Because on the one hand, it's all well and good to simply say, well, they're printing a ton of money, so that's obviously going to have an inflationary outcome. But there are many different kinds of inflation. So there's the kind of inflation that central banks that they measure. So if we think about central banks, well, they don't look at commodity prices, and they're not particularly worried about the day-to-day spending patterns of people. The kinds of things, though, that they do pay attention to are rent prices. They don't look at the property price overall, but they do look at rent. And, well, if we were landlords and we had tenants that weren't paying their rent and the moratorium on evictions ends, well, we might decide that we would like to get our property back. But the other thing that when we're signing up a new tenant, well, we're going to ask for either an additional security deposit or we're going to ask for more rent in order to compensate us for the risk of a malingerer. And that would apparently be what is in store for rental prices. And then, of course, because we've had higher property prices over the course of the last year, where we've seen the price of property jumping higher in the USA, the UK, Australia, and Canada, and lots of other places to boot, where demand for property in China has also jumped higher as well. So that's another destination for where a lot of this excess liquidity that's been provided over the course of the last year has appeared. And if we do start to see higher rental prices, well, then that will feed through into the kind of inflation that central banks do look at. Now, of course, in here this week, we had the CPI figure, and we had a lot of hoopla about the year-over-year comparison. And I'm not especially impressed by it, because we can look at the long-term history, and this has been an exceedingly long range where this year-over-year headline inflation has been ranging between about 0 and 5% since the early 1980s. There have been brief flurries both above and below at the upper and lower side of this range, and we're at the upper side, but of course we've have this also this huge comparison with last year. And if we look at month over month, I think it puts it into perspective, because I don't have any credence in year-over-year comparisons in the short term, at least for the next couple of quarters. They're going to be extraordinarily loopy, and drawing conclusions from that, I think, is just going to be wasted time. When we look at month-over-month figures, we're up to about 0.6%. So that is an increase, and it is a pop on the upside, up and out of this range where there's been resistance around a half of a percent since the beginning of 2010. And over the course of the last 40 years, any significant breakout above 50 basis points has not been sustained. So if we are going to see an inflationary trend, I think this is the index we need to pay attention to. We've had a brief flurry of activity, and then it was a little softer over the course of the last month. And if it pulls back down below the 50 basis point level in the next reading, well, then I think people are not going to be as worried about inflation. And I do believe that this is why we've had some moderation in government bond yields. And it's also part of the reason why we're starting to see central banks talking about transitory inflation, because they just don't see these comparisons and the clear actions that people have as if they believe that there is inflation. Because the one thing that people do when they really believe in inflation is they start to deploy assets in a preemptive manner. If you really believe there's going to be an inflationary environment, well, you buy now. You don't wait for a year. And certainly we've seen some of that in the property markets, that interest rates are at rock bottom levels. People were cashed up, so they invested in houses. So there's a degree of preemptive buying in that kind of decision-making process. It certainly played a part in Mrs. Tracy and my decision to purchase a home in the last 3 months. But then we can also think about corporations, and they're not abandoning just-in-time inventory management. When you go to Best Buy or Home Depot or any of these companies, they generally don't hold inventory. They're holding one or two pieces of each item. So when you go to Best Buy, they'll say, "Hurry, there's only two left in stock," because that's all they had in the first place. So just-in-time manufacturing is just a way of participating with the market that's inherently deflationary. You delay purchases rather than front-load purchases because there's no price pressure. So this, I think, is something that's kind of interesting. When do you get price pressures and incentives? You get it when prices are rising. And this is obviously something that may also feed through into renewable energy. Because over the course of the last week or two, there's been news that China is apparently unable to continue to produce solar cells at ever lower prices. And I think this is an interesting phenomenon because I know I've certainly I haven't replied to any of the ads that have come through the door asking to install solar panels on the roof. And the reason I didn't do that was because I was always thinking that, well, if I were to install panels now and then the technology improves or the costs come down, well, then what's on my roof is going to be a very quickly wasting asset. So I delayed that purchase. But now, if we start to see solar panels beginning to trend higher, well, then consumers will conclude that if they want to get them, then now's the time. And then, of course, there's also the technology question and about how good is good enough. So the solar ETF is still firming in the region of the trend mean. And the question is, are they going to get pricing power? Will people pay up because they're worried about prices rising in future? 10-year Treasury yields were a little bit steadier in here today, but they've come down in a dynamic manner this week. And this is a new low. And it's certainly a breakdown from the range that's been forming over the course of the last 3 months. I've been positioned very on, and on, then I was stopped, or I guess I closed it out because I was anticipating that there would be a reversionary move in terms of the price, and we're getting it now. And the bigger question is, how much further will it go? Obviously, governments are broke, and the last thing they want is higher interest rates, and they obviously have this challenge in terms of funding their operations when bond yields rise. And the bond market is willing to give some credence to the view that inflationary pressures are transitory. And outside of wages, and we've seen that wages have started to trend higher, and rents are likely to trend higher, but construction materials are coming back in a big way, considering that lumber was trading around $1,700 in May and it's at 1,060 today and limit down again. Well, this is a clear unwinding of a very accelerated trend overall, and it is supportive of the view that that was a short-term supply bottleneck. Another short-term supply bottleneck is in shipping. And those friends of mine that own factories in Los Angeles have been complaining incessantly for the last year about the union-led revolt in the docks in Los Angeles Port. What was happening was that if somebody on a shift was diagnosed with COVID-19, then the whole shift went into quarantine. But they didn't test anybody on the shift, they just assumed that they were all contagious. And what that contributed to was a massive backlog, and it has also contributed to this increased demand for furniture. When you're told you can't buy it, well, then people wanted more. And of course, then you also have in shipping the IMO 2020 regulations. Now, they went into effect on the 1st of January 2020, and we can go back and look at what was happening in advance of that. The Baltic Dry Index was breaking on the upside in 2019. It was pausing in the region of the upper side of the base, and then it broke down in a very dynamic manner. But I think we can look back at more history and see just how depressed prices were, how convincingly the upward dynamic that we saw yesterday is demonstrating support in the region of the upper side of the base formation. And this is an additional cost that is being applied to global markets. So shipping costs are certainly going to rise, and they will find their way into consumer prices. And shipping companies have been very forthright in saying that they're going to pass on the additional carbon remediation costs that they have to deploy in order to comply with the IMO 2020 regulations. They're just going to pass them on to consumers. And the customers of the shipping companies are just going to simply pass them on as well. Well, that's also inflationary. And of course, then we have carbon prices. So I think everyone is at least familiar with some argument about global warming. And then there are lots of arguments about whether there's anything that can be done about it, or how much should be done about it, or that nobody is doing enough about it. And there is obviously the real concern about the pace of extinctions and what everyone is worried about in terms of the pollution in some of the major conurbations around the world. And Europe is doing more than anybody to price carbon in an aggressive manner. So the price has rebounded in a pretty emphatic fashion from around the $50 area. And this is directly inflationary because it is imposing additional costs. And there was a common statistic quoted about oil in the commodity bull market of the early 2000s. And it was something to the effect that every $10 rally in the oil price corresponded with a hit to economic growth of about 0.2%. And I wonder, is that still the case? Because back then, it was very much relevant for the US economy because it was a major energy importer, and now they're an energy exporter. So there is the potential that there is a balance point somewhere where reasonably high prices are more conducive to economic growth than somewhat lower prices. But when we start to factor in carbon credits, how high do carbon credits have to go before they have a deleterious effect on the economy? But carbon is also an additional tax. It's a tax on production and consumption, and those costs will be passed on to consumers. So then we have the real potential that as consumers see the costs of consumer goods and services rising, that they will demand higher wages. And you have the additional point that people fared really rather well during the pandemic, and particularly so in the USA, where there were a substantial number of people, almost 50% of the population, were making more from unemployment benefits than they did from working. Now, if that's not going to foster a sense of entitlement in the broader community, then I just can't imagine what will. So there's obviously the potential that that is going to feed through into wage demand growth. And I really think that this is very similar to what happened in the early 1970s, because in the late 1960s we had a great deal of social problems. There were massive protests about the Vietnam War. There were a large number of assassinations of key political and religious figures. And then governments panicked, and they were really afraid of revolution. So they gave the people what they want. They went on an epic building spree, and they started building lots of houses and tried and really civilized the hippie generation by giving them mortgages to pay. And at the same time, they monetized the debt, so the purchasing power of fiat currencies went into decline, and commodities took off like a rocket, not only because of the devaluation of the fiat currencies, but also because of consumer demand. And then the clear willingness of the central banks to print as much as was required to fund the deficits. Well, there's going to be a lot of printing because the total deficit that is outstanding is somewhere in the region of about 2 trillion. And this figure jumps around quite a bit because depending on the schedule that different economic statistics are released at. But the deficit has been trending higher on a global basis for years, and it accelerates higher during crises. I think the most important thing, and again, doesn't seem to get nearly as much attention now as it used to, but it was that the deficit's been rising in the USA since 2018. The Trump tax cuts were one of the biggest pro-cyclical spikes in spending that have really ever been seen. So most rational people can understand that counter-cyclical stimulus makes sense, that when the economy is doing badly, you stimulate. When the economy does well, you don't. And you try to prepare and raise interest rates and curtail spending in advance of the next time when you need to provide the assistance. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what the USA did with the Trump tax cuts and the holiday on repatriating funds from overseas. We had a phenomenal move in 2017 where the market just did not look back. So despite the fact that the Federal Reserve was going through a period of quantitative tightening, the fiscal impetus that more than made up for the bullish outlook overall. And at the moment, we're at a point where central banks are providing massive assistance and governments are printing money. So we have combined monetary and fiscal stimulus. We are, however, starting to see some evidence of countries beginning to pull back from quantitative easing. So Canada has been the first of those. You have the UK beginning to talk about the possibility of normalizing policy. So they're talking about it, but they're not really doing anything about it. And 10-year gilts were also lower in here today. And then you have commodity exporters like Canada and indeed Russia, where they're further along in the normalization process. So Russia raised interest rates today, and they may do more, and the ruble continues to steady. Well, when we think about the countries that want weaker currencies, nobody wants a weaker currency more than the USA does. So the dollar index was stronger in here today. Now, I think this is some short covering and some steadying in the region of the lower side of the range ahead of the Fed funds meeting, just in case the Federal Reserve decides to surprise the market and taper, for example, some of their mortgage bond purchases. But we're at the lower side of an extremely lengthy range, and it has type 3 top formation characteristics. And the longer term cycle is certainly on the downside. So there is obviously potential here that we might get a little bit of steadying in the short term, and ultimately the index will break on the downside. Well, every time it looks like fiat currencies are going to be devalued, and we're going to see the purchasing power of the money in our pockets losing value, that's good for gold. Every time the dollar rallies, well, it's not great for gold. This looks like a consolidation in the region of the $1,900 area. I think every investor is aware of the size of the downward dynamics we saw in November and in January. So they are a little reticent to jump into this market and start buying in an aggressive manner. The big question is, how well are we going to find support? At what point are we going to see clear evidence of demand starting to come back in? We've had a really impressive rebound off the lows, and now the big question is, where are we going to see a higher reaction low? In order to clearly demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment, gold will have to find support at a level above the $1,700 area. There's been a lot of talk about Basel III and the impact that it will have on gold. I would rather hesitate to draw too many conclusions because the news of this has been percolating through the market for 2 years. We've already had a substantial rally. So I think the Basel III rally has already taken place. And now the bigger question is what's going to happen in terms of the devaluation of fiat currencies? Because certainly some economies are normalizing policy. The USA is a long way from doing that. And the most important thing is not so much that they're waiting for the trend of inflation to increase. Instead, I think more importantly is that they are increasingly talking about social issues. And central banks don't generally talk about social issues. When they start talking about fairness and giving everyone a fair shot, that's generally where fiscal policy comes in. But instead, we're getting the central banks talking about it. And that at least suggests that they're going to continue to support a very liquid price environment. So that is supportive of gold prices rising overall. Then, if we go back and think about the inflationary question, I think there are two additional points that are worth considering. And the first is that emerging Asia export prices have turned the corner. So it is looking quite likely that this is going to trend higher. So China's population is aging. And then there is this revolt going on among regular people where they're being told to breed and they are refusing. And then there's an additional movement emerging in China of passive revolt because people can't revolt against the administration. So instead, what people are doing is they're deciding to stop engaging with the market. So they're not buying houses and they're not buying cars and they're deciding that they're not going to buy luxury goods. And there is a certain amount of rebellion in these types of decisions that you can tell us how to live and you can tell us what we can and can't say, but you can't dictate how we spend our money. And that is a growing trend in China. So when we think about the renminbi, they've been very clear in attempting to build a consumer-led economy and a services-based economy, and to a greater or lesser extent, that's been achieved. But the animism of the consumer base is therefore then what is the foundation of growth in the economy. And if consumers revolt and they just stop buying, well, that's something that will contribute to greater monetary support. And there's been a lot of talk about what's going on in China in terms of the credit cycle rolling over. So they're certainly trying to normalize policy, and the renminbi has strengthened to new highs, and it has been easing now as the dollar has steadied. Then we can think about what's going on in terms of commodity markets. Well, commodity price inflation is quite likely to appear here. The copper price is right in the region of its all-time peak, and you have China announcing that they are going to make significant distributions from their national stockpiles. And we're right in the region of the all-time peak, so it's a natural area where we might anticipate some resistance coming through. And they are clearly attempting to target some of the biggest import markets for the country. So it's going to be copper, aluminium, zinc, and potentially iron ore. And that's an attempt to curtail price increases. But then we have to think about the rest of the world. And what's the rest of the world doing? Well, they're very keen on building an entirely new energy infrastructure. And renewables have been on the front foot for most of the last decade. And there's the and coming out of the credit crisis, there was an attempt to try and inflate asset prices, and it was enormously successful. So that created a populist backlash because the fruits from that endeavor were very unevenly spread. So now, as we come out of the pandemic and governments are looking about how to placate very un or I think the unrest in a large number of countries, well, they are going to try and give people what they want. And what a lot of people are campaigning for is a better future, a cleaner future, and a future driven by renewable energy. So that's where carbon taxes are coming from. And then it's also where demand for commodities is coming from, because to build all of this infrastructure is going to require a very significant investment, and it could be in the order of trillions of dollars. So this is similar in magnitude to the industrialization of China that began in the early 2000s. So any measure that China takes to try and bring prices down is probably going to be a buying opportunity, because they don't have all of the resources required to completely offset the demand growth. And it would suggest that we're going to see a buy in the dip, or that there will be potentially at least the scope that copper could pull back and offer a better buying opportunity. When we think about the dollar and emerging markets, well, if commodities are doing well, then that's also beneficial for emerging markets. And this again is a rerun of the kind of market environment that we had in the early 2000s. So we had a phenomenal bust because of the massive overvaluation that we had on Wall Street. So people are still worried today about the potential for a big crash. That's very similar to what we have after every other crash. People are waiting for the second shoe to drop. They anticipate that there's going to be another enormous problem, and they don't generally then occur, because thinking about the potential for another crash just a year after the last one, it's too early. The kinds of things that we would monitor for signs of liquidity tightening up are just not apparent. Central banks are not reducing the size of their balance sheets. The high yield spread is still extremely tight. And we're back at levels that haven't been seen since 2014. When we think about bond yields, well, they're not surging higher. And governments are worried about not spending enough. And we're still in an uncertain environment. This is eerily similar to the same kind of stresses that we had in 2010 and 11. People thought that the credit crisis was going to happen all over again, and that it was inevitable that every bank was eventually going to go bust, and that no one would ever be able to borrow money again. And then we can think about today that there's this pandemic, and it has been incredibly debilitating, and that there are going to be new variants that pop up all the time, and that we're going to be in and out of lockdowns forever, and that there is the potential that a new pandemic is going to emerge, and that everyone is going to be locked up indefinitely, and that we'll never be able to fly anywhere again, that the and that our lives have been changed indefinitely. But one thing that we can certainly say is that despite the fear about the pandemic, its ability to influence markets has declined substantially over the course of the last while. So we can think, for example, about the UK. because the only headlines that I see about the UK are about the rising numbers of the Delta variant, and one would think that this is going to have a massively deleterious effect on the stock market. Well, the FTSE 250 is still pushing on to new high ground and made a new high last week. So, yes, there is potential for some consolidation, but we have no evidence that the coronavirus is still capable of influencing investor decisions. And that suggests that we're going to get into a normalization factor. Well, back in 2010, nobody wanted to believe that banks would be back at their peaks within a decade, or that the S&P 500 banks index would be back at its peak within a decade, or that we were going to have a phenomenal bull market, or that the breakouts that we were starting to see in the autonomies were going to translate into these epic trends over the next decade. But what people were really worried about was that we were going to have another crash. And people are justifiably worried about inflation. But the reality is that assuming we're correct that there is, or that we now have the seeds for a new inflationary cycle, and that producer prices coming out of Asia are rising, and the regulatory burden on the shipping sector is rising, and in increasing costs, and that carbon emissions prices are rising and increasing costs, and that wage demand growth is going to be required in order to compensate for all of these additional costs, and that all of this money that's been created is creating this high valuation environment, and particularly in private assets. So these are all factors that will contribute to inflation, or that we're going to see a big pop on the upside in the rents demanded. But the effects for most of these factors are in the future, and the evidence that is being presented to us right now about inflation is not convincing. So this is why we've had a moderation in bond yields, because investors are worried about inflation, but what they're really worried about is potential inflation. And what we have today is unconvincing evidence of inflation. The significant downdraft that we've had in lumber prices is one of the primary reasons why people continue to think that this is a transitory effect. So I think these are, if we're going to think about the long-term argument about inflation is much more convincing than the short-term one, because governments need to devalue their currencies. This massive quantity of money that is sitting out there is something that is not going to go away, and the debts will get paid back eventually. And the carbon taxes that are being imposed are one way of getting that done, but it's a fig leaf compared to the spending programs. And the spending programs are extremely substantial. Now, when we think about then the valuation on the stock market, well, the only thing that is holding up the continued performance of the S&P 500 is the fact that the dollar has not yet broken down. And the S&P was able to recoup all of its losses in here today and to close at a new all-time peak. And it has been ranging for 2 months, so it's potentially now on the cusp of breaking on the upside. And the Nasdaq 100 has been going sideways for even longer, and it's now right in the region of the highs again with another positive performance. The linchpin for the continued outperformance of Europe is in how well the dollar holds the decline, because the Euro Stoxx index continues to push on the upside. The Australian ASX 200 is going to also be more attractive to foreign investors because of the relative strength of the Australian dollar. The Canadian dollar has continued to appreciate. So the TSX continues to push on to new high ground. When we look at the Chinese market, then we've had this substantial breakout in the renminbi over the course of the last few months, and then the CSI 300 is firming from the region of the trend mean, but it is not performing nearly as well as other markets because of the questions about governance. So as we look around the world and at the potential that the dollar is going to trend lower, that is particularly beneficial for commodity producers because of the inverse correlation between commodities and the US dollar. We can then think about Brazil having been out in the cold from the perspective of international investors for most of the last decade, and it continues to rally up towards the upper side of what's almost an 8-year base formation. And then we can think about the Latin America dollar index, and it has got base formation characteristics, at least over the last 18 months. But again, it's a currency index that has been doing nothing but decline for a decade. And we have these large numbers of international markets where they've been going sideways for a profound amount of time and are now just breaking on the upside. So Taiwan in particular has got a high beta, I guess, and I will put that back into local currencies, but it's got a high beta way of trading compared to Japan. And part of the reason for that is that it was the first destination for Japanese companies as they went back out overseas. So the Nikkei is pausing around the 30,000 level, but it looks quite likely that it will follow the Taiwanese market higher. And when we think about the TOPIX index, well, it had been ranging below the 1700 point level for almost 30 years and then broke out. So this just looks like a consolidation overall. And more likely than not, that this looks, well, it looks like a rounding, extraordinarily lengthy base formation. So as we look around the world, then there are clear potentials that non-US dollar denominated assets are going to perform, and that they will outperform over the lengthy medium term, provided that the US dollar does in fact trend down. So that's been questioned today, but I just don't think that it's anything other than a short-term steadying, and that as we look out into the horizon, there is just no country wants a stronger currency, excuse me, a weaker, sorry. There's no country wants a strong currency. Some need a weaker currency more than others. And right now, the country that wants and needs a weaker currency more than others is the USA, because they have a restive population who are demanding massive social change, and it just does not come cheap. Now, as we then think about the outlook overall, well, we're still in a benign environment. There is no evidence that we are moving into the next recession. There is the potential that we're going to see massive catch-up plays in emerging markets and Europe and Japan and commodity-related markets over the course of the next several years, that we have the scope for some consolidation in the commodity market, but that there is clear potential that it is going to turn into a commodity-led inflationary cycle, and there will be real fears about financial repression. Because how could there not be when we have artificially suppressed interest rates, massive money printing, huge deficits, and no real plan on how to rein in that kind of spending? So we're certainly in a benign economic environment, and really only at the beginning of this recovery overall. We've definitely seen, and no question about it, parts of the economy that have done exceptionally well and have got extremely high valuations. And we can also think about the very significant bull market we had in 2020 and early 2021 in cryptocurrencies. So Bitcoin went from about 4,000 and change in March to 65,000. So that was a reflection of just how much money printing was going on. Of course, the more money printing that goes on, the more likely it is that these alternative ways of attracting liquidity will continue to do well as well. Now, Bitcoin has bounced because you've had people doubling down and borrowing hundreds of millions to go out and buy them. But the most important thing about a momentum move is you need to have successive waves of new money coming in. And the nice thing about a momentum move is that you get to increase the size of your positions by using your paper profits as collateral. And when you don't have paper profits, it's harder to get it going. So you need a clear rationale to get investors to coalesce around the idea. Well, it's very much also based upon this meme phenomenon. So we've had a lot of activity in these smaller companies, and they have jumped into large cap status because of people willing to bet that everyone else will buy them too. This is emblematic of a bull market, and it's the kind of thing that people will look back on in the future, and they will be surprised that anyone could get away with it. And when you have an artist selling nothing for $18,000, well, one has to question just the rationality of the market. So the rationality of the market coming into question is a trend-ending signal, but the reality is that the market can stay irrational longer than we can stay liquid. So there is a lot of funny business going on in the market right now, but there is still a lot of liquidity floating around, and we still have consistent trends, and we don't have any of the factors that would normally contribute to lead indicators for a recession flashing red, and they're not even flashing yellow. And the financial conditions indices are still at record easy levels. And as long as that remains the case, well, then this is still a reasonably benign environment. And we have had a little bit of positioning this week ahead of the Fed meeting because there's speculation that they're going to change their minds. Well, I'm just doubtful that they're going to announce anything really material because they said in plain English what they want. They have not yet achieved it, and to flip-flop would be a real sign of weakness. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.